I believe it's time for us to start this period. So if everybody would please be seated. My name is L.E. Parker. I came from California, and I would like to convey to you the good wishes, the love, the regards of those brethren in California. And I had the privilege this last week of attending the Bible school in New Mexico, and there were those there who wished to be remembered to you here. And this brings up one of the very beautiful points of the truth that we share here. And that is the things that we have in common with each other. Doesn't matter whether you're on the West Coast, the East Coast, whether you're in the South, the Southwest, Middle West, wherever. Wherever brethren are gathered, when you walk by and hear what they have to say, what they're talking about, and when you come to find their beliefs, it's all the same. You feel that you certainly are among friends wherever you are, and you have a lot in common. Now, the subject that I have chosen to discuss with you at this time is entitled The Believer in the Time of the End. Now, presumably, as we gather here for this Bible school, we would be agreed that we are living in or very near what the prophet Daniel referred to as the time of the end. Now, no one knew in years past just what turn events would take to make it difficult to maintain a grasp, a firm grasp, on the truth that Brother Alex spoke to us about this morning, being rediscovered some 100 years ago. But all agreed for many years that it would become difficult as the time of the end drew toward its close, that it would become most difficult to maintain that firm grasp on the truth. Now, during these periods here that we hope to share with you, we may be talking about some of the things that we should be doing that we aren't, and some of the things that we are doing, perhaps, that we should not be doing. Now, when we hear things of this kind sitting out in the audience, whether we're from New England or California or wherever, we're apt to have one of two reactions to that. And either one of these reactions prevents us from gaining what we really should from what we are hearing. That is, the first one may be, well, you know, that guy's talking right to me. He knows what I'm doing or what I'm thinking, and you know, he's just singling me right out for criticism and talking directly to me. And the other reaction perhaps may be, I wish Brother X were here. You know, that's exactly what he needs to hear. You know, I wish we would have gotten him here. Now, either one of these things, as I say, either one of these reactions will prevent us from learning what we really should pick up from what we hear. Because certainly a speaker or a teacher should not take the advantage of having a captive audience and criticize somebody personally. And I don't think this happens, not very often anyway. What we're really presenting to you are things that have happened to us for the most part. And we recognize our own shortcomings, we recognize that we need help, and we are simply sharing what we feel and what our reactions have been with you. Now, the other reaction may be a little more serious, because there's a whole attitude here, or a philosophy, if you please, involved in this when we're talking about Brother X ought to be here. Because we are so inclined not to stop and weigh and consider and evaluate our own position. It always looks all right to us, and you know, this is the Proverbs, the words of the Proverbs. A man's ways are right in his own eyes, And we're so apt to always take this attitude and be in this position of feeling that we're all right. Now, it's very easy to look at Brother X and think about what's wrong with him. And very often, under the guise of appearing to want to help Brother X, we'll criticize. It's a little easier to criticize to each other than it is to him, but we may criticize to him. But the point is, and this may has its place too, by the way, but we should be sure when we do this that our motive is one of love and understanding and long-suffering and temperance and patience and all of the things that we should have. But we are so apt to overlook, as we say, what our position really is, and we like to look at the other fellows and pick out what's wrong with him or her. And that is not good. To start with here this morning, I would like to, if you would let me indulge myself a bit, resort to some reminiscing. As a very young child, I grew up in a very remote part of New Mexico. Any of you who have been to the New Mexico Bible School know how remote. But I grew up under Christadelphian or in a Christadelphian atmosphere. And some of the things that were believed among those brethren remain very vivid in my mind at this time. Now, the first thing that really impressed me that the brethren believed and taught at that time was the second coming of Christ. That Christ was actually coming back to earth. The possibility of divine intervention in the affairs of man was fascinating to me, and it still is. But at that time, the brethren, one of the verses that was very prominent in the teachings of the brethren there was Acts 1:11, where Christ had just ascended up into heaven, and the angel stood by and said, "Ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? For this same Jesus that you see go into heaven shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go." Now, this was a very important verse to the brethren in that day and time, and it's still important. Of course, nowadays, for us to talk about the second coming of Christ is not so unusual, because there are a lot of people who have some version of the second coming of Christ in their thinking. They are looking. Of course, it's not the version we don't believe not very often that we find taught in the Bible, but they do have some kind of thinking along this line. But in those days, when I was a youngster, it was unusual. In fact, we were the only ones, as far as I knew at the time, who believed this. Now, there were other ideas that impressed me, and I still think about. Now, this takes us back to those days following World War I, a number of years after the war. And many of the people in the world had high hopes, because the problems of the world had been solved. They had just fought a major war, a worldwide war, to end all wars. Now we were going to have peace. And the League of Nations had been formed. This was going to guarantee that the nations would never go to war one with the other again. But you know, the Christadelphians were rather pessimistic, they were very pessimistic about this. Because they said, it will never happen like this. It is not in man to direct his paths. Man is never going to find a complete and perfect solution to his problems. He is never going to find just and lasting peace. The League of Nations are going to be completely incapable of accomplishing this. So this is what their feelings were. They said, rather, there's going to be continued preparation for war. Men are going to continue to beat their plowshares in the swords and their pruning hooks into spears. There is going to continue to be wars and rumors of wars as long as man is trying to rule the world. Because of the conflicting interest of selfishness, the desire for and lust for wealth and power, is going to cause man to always be pulling one against another There is this special interest group. There is this special interest group. And there's always going to be problems, and these problems are going to manifest themselves in wars and preparation for war and rumors of war. This is always going to be with us. Also, they had another rather unusual idea, and that is they thought that from the words of prophecy, compared with the words of Dr. Thomas that we've been hearing about after he was more mature in his thinking, they felt that they even could predict the way the nations were going to react and how they were going to align themselves. First of all, they said there were going to be two confederacy of nations, with the great nation of Russia aligning herself on the one side, Britain and the United States on the other side. Now, this, they felt, was described to them in the words of prophecy. Now, it seemed rather unusual at that time to look for the backward nation of Russia to assume a world role such as was described by the brethren in that day and time, but they felt sure that the word of prophecy indicated this. For example, the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, where we read the words, Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. They were convinced that these words referred to the nation of Russia. And they went out on a limb to say that the time would come when Russia would assume the role of world leadership in her part of the world, and that there were things indicated that she would do as a result. There was another real strange idea that the brethren held in that day and time. And the other people in the community thought, these people have really gone off the deep end now. But the Jewish people were scattered among all the nations of the world, every nation under heaven. But the Christadelphians said the time's coming when God will gather those people back to their own land. They will be brought back there. And as we say, this was the straw that broke the camel's back as far as the people in the community were concerned. Those people, you can't believe anything they say when they have such strange ideas as that. And they even went so far as to say that the time would come when all nations would focus their attention on the Holy Land, the Middle East, and the homeland of the Jew. And people would ask, why? What reason could you possibly think the nations of the world would be interested and focus their attention on that barren land of sand and stone and brush? What value could it possibly have? And so the Christadelphians were ridiculed for believing this. And they taught also that when the situation were right, that Russia would move down, that Russia would move into that area, and that she would be opposed there by another league or confederacy of nations headed up by the United States and Great Britain. And the teaching was that Russia would be victorious initially in her quest in that area, and that all of this would culminate in what we started out talking about, the second coming of Christ. That this was the thing that would ultimately bring Christ back to set up the kingdom. That this would be the thing that would usher in divine interference in the affairs of men. And this is what would be required to find just and lasting peace and find a solution to all the world's problems. Because it was insisted that man was incapable of doing this. Now, it's interesting to look back some 40 years later and at how this has developed, whether or not the brethren were correct in their assessment of the situation. And it's amazing how accurately things have developed along the lines the Christadelphians were expecting 40 and 50 years ago. It has come about. Now, of course, We know that Dr. Thomas was not able to accurately predict the date, but we read that no man knows the day nor the hour. And an old brother I used to know said, and I don't think they know the year either. And that's still, I believe, correct. However, the things he was looking for, the things that he was expecting, and the things that brethren in the days that I'm referring to were expecting, has come down to us one by one, just as they were expecting. Now, of course, we always point to this one thing that has not happened exactly as we were expecting, as the part Britain would play in the affairs of the world near the end of time and the coming of Christ, because Britain has lost her power to quite an extent, almost entirely, as a matter of fact. However, not that we want to try at any cost to justify what Dr. Thomas has written along this line, but Britain has done a lot more of the things that he predicted she would do than we might think. Because being prominent in the Middle East, in Egypt, making it possible for the Jews to go back there and establish a homeland there, all of these things Dr. Thomas predicted Britain would do, and she has done. Now, the thing that he did not see, I don't believe completely anyway, and we didn't in the past see either, was the fact that Britain would not stay strong there until the actual return of Christ. But she has accomplished many of those things that Dr. Thomas was looking for. And I heard an interesting thought expressed at the New Mexico Bible School the other day. Brother expressed the idea that since Britain has discovered oil in the North Sea there, this may indicate that she's going to stage a comeback, that in the very last days of Gentile time, Britain may come back. Now, this may or may not occur, but it's an interesting thought to think about it. Now, we have talked about the fact that we feel, certainly, we are living in the last days of Gentile time. And this is what our remarks are going to, this is not a class, not going to be a class on prophecy, per se, but we are going to be referring to this fact. And the difficulties of brethren living in these precarious times. Because it becomes very difficult at times for us to know what our place should be in this society, what we should do, how we should conduct ourselves. Because we recall that Christ did not pray to God that his followers be taken out of the world, but that they should be kept from evil. So here we are in the winding down of the Gentile times, living in rather precarious times, but it's a good testing ground for us. No doubt our characters will be developed if we are exercised by these things we are confronted with, as we should be. No doubt our character will be built as a result of this. We will be stronger. We will be better people. We will have a better opportunity to find a place in the kingdom of God as a result of these difficult times in which we live. So let us take a brief look at what is going on in these times. First of all, our everyday life probably brings us in contact more in a more personal way with the situation than anything else. And one of the things that impresses us is the decay of moral principles and values in the world. You know, there was a time when the people of the world didn't have the truth of the gospel, but they conducted themselves, their standard of conduct was for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, along the lines prescribed by the Word of God. But we find that deteriorating very rapidly in the days in which we live. We find that dishonesty has come to be an accepted way of life, not only by those in the back alleys, not only those on the wrong side of the tracks, but in high places we find dishonesty becoming, and in fact I think we've discovered it has been a way of life in high places for a long time. We find crime rising at a frightening rate, violent crime increasing tremendously. so that we don't know whether we're safe to go out of our homes. In fact, we don't even know whether we're safe in our homes or not in this situation. We see all about us problems in the economy. And we are well aware of the fact that we just have come out, the politicians tell us we've come out of a period of time when there was both recession and inflation at the same time, something that perhaps we've never had before. We have also in this day and time the threat of overpopulation and a shortage of food. And even the governments, the municipalities, the counties, the state, and even the federal government is on the very verge of bankruptcy. We heard a great deal about the financial plight of New York City in recent months, but I'm sure that all of us recognize that if Washington didn't have a printing press, Washington would be bankrupt too. In fact, it may be. We find unemployment going at a frightful clip. Now, the reason we're bringing these things to you is when we analyze the situation in the environment, in the economy, in the overpopulation and the food shortage, the possibility of shortage of food, we recognize that everything is coming to an end. All of these things are converging one with another. Now, we can recognize, we don't know how long it's going to take. We'll still go back to the brother's statement that we don't think we know the year either that Christ is going to come. But we can see, certainly, all of these things going toward the end of Gentile time. They're all winding up. These things can't continue to go on as they are. Inflation, that alone is enough to completely wreck civilization as we know it. And in addition to this, as we've mentioned, the environment, pollution of the food and the air and the water, and even the energy crisis is asserting itself. And we do find that on both a national and international level, that the nations have aligned themselves, as described in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, as we view it. We certainly feel. Now, and these nations, interestingly enough, are focusing their attention on the Middle East. That's where they recognize that the balance of world power rests. But now we know why. Because it has become apparent that the Middle East is a very strategic and a very important and a very wealthy part of the world. We have there, first of all, location. It's a very strategic location, and it has been. Even before the time of Christ, the armies of the nations marched through there. It's like a land bridge between three continents. So it's a very strategic location. We find the Suez Canal there, part of the world commerce network. And, of course, oil. We need not mention this. This is well known to everybody, the fact that the Western world has to have that oil from the Middle East. Russia knows this. Russia recognizes that if she could control the oil in the Middle East, then she could control the world. She would have the world by the throat if she could control that oil there. And, of course, Israel is there. This wild, unreasonable idea that the brethren held 40 and 50 years ago, and of course even further back than that, that God would one day regather the Jewish people to their former homeland, has now been realized initially. Now, we recognize that that's not going to be accomplished in the full sense of the word until the return of Christ. But we see the beginning of the fulfillment of that prophecy of the regathering of the Jews and coming back into their homeland. And let us look at the conditions in the Middle East. This is not only the focal point of the nations of the world, it is the focal point of the believers as well. Let's look at conditions there. First of all, we see the antagonism, the hatred, the envy that is so apparent in the Middle East between the Israelis and their neighbors. We see the desire on the part of the neighbors of Israel to drive her into the sea, to destroy her as a nation. We see, or at least we have been told, that Israel now possesses the atomic bomb and that she would not hesitate to use it if she were driven to it. As a matter of fact, newsmen are telling us now that the atomic bombs were distributed to the various air arms of Israel during the war of 1972, when there was some question as to whether or not the Israeli defense would hold. So that the bomb could have been used at that point, we are now told. This has been kept back up to this point. And we see the small nations in the Middle East spending billions of dollars to arm themselves. Truly, the Middle East has become a powder keg that could explode at any time. All these small nations buying this tremendous arsenals that they are buying at this time, we wonder if this could be reminiscent of the prophecy in Micah chapter 3, verse 9 and 10, where we read, "Let the weak say, I am strong." So these nations want to feel that they are strong, that they can hold their own, that they can defend themselves. But in so doing, they may very well be establishing a situation that will lead to their absolute destruction. Now we, of course, are interested in the civil war in Lebanon. Of course, when you're at a Bible school, you don't hear much news, and it might be over for all I know, because I've been at a Bible school for a week and I haven't heard any news. But we doubt that it's over. And it, of course, is a vital concern to the whole world, because we recognize that it could result in a complete war in the Middle East. It could result in a confrontation between Russia and the United States and their allies right there in the Middle East. Something ultimately is going to lead to that confrontation. We do not know what it is. We do not know how soon it's going to come about. But we know that sooner or later, Russia is going to march her forces into the Middle East and that she's going to be confronted there by the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof. Now, it's true we cannot identify these merchants of Tarshish and the young lions as accurately as we believe we can, Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, but we believe this to be trading powers and personified to us perhaps in the United States and Britain and their allies. Now, we always would like to know the significance of the things that we see happening in the Middle East and worldwide, for that matter, that speak to us of the nearness of the return of Christ. And we try to place these things in order, and sometimes it's a little discouraging because it's very difficult to evaluate events at the time they're happening. Now, historians are current writers, rather, have always had this problem. After these things have happened and settled down and we see their place in the development of things, then it's much easier to evaluate them and see how important they were. Now, today, many things that we would like to know about and know what they mean and what's going to be the result of them at the time kind of fade away and didn't do quite what we thought they might. And so we sometimes are a little disappointed. But we're not really discouraged because we might compare the whole situation to a giant glacier that's on a mountainside and it's gradually sliding down toward the sea. And there's no one particular thing that just cuts it loose and makes it slide down like a bolt of lightning. But everything that happens causes it to slide a little bit. It's gradually sliding. It's working its way down the mountainside. This is the way the affairs of the world are now, at this time. They are sliding. They cannot reverse themselves. It's inevitable that ultimately this giant glacier will fall into the sea. But it has often been said that God is not in a hurry. He has time. He's working these things out in his own way as he has decreed they should be. Sometimes we may become a little impatient. We'd like to see it slide a little faster. But we can see things going on. We can see prophecy being fulfilled before our very eyes. Now we, of course, are concerned with the future, with the immediate future. Of course, our primary concern is the future involving the kingdom of God, the coming of Christ, and these things, but we are concerned about the immediate future. Now, at this point, we might say there may be some here who do not share our point of view relative to these matters. But we, and certainly, the last thing we want to do is say anything that will be offensive to you. We do not wish to do this. However, let us look together at the prospects for the future. This is an election year, and we've been exposed to a tremendous amount of political rhetoric in the last several months. And they're all saying what Christadelphians have said for 50 years and 100 years and over, that things are not good. That the things the government's supposed to be doing, the things the people are supposed to be doing, is not working out very well. It needs to be improved. It needs to be completely overhauled. We've known this for a long time. The politicians are saying it now. And they're all saying what you need to do is give us a clear majority of votes so that we can do these things. We can get down to business. But now, let's look at man's record. Now, if you go to buy a home, and you go to a bank and a savings and loan, to arrange for a loan to finance that purchase, what are they going to want to know? They want to know how you've paid in the past. And if you've paid all right, you're going to get the loan in all probability. But if you haven't, they're not interested. The door's right there, and here's your hat. And they won't even say, what's your hurry? Get out of here. Don't bother me. If you can't pay your bills, I don't want anything to do with you. All right, let us look at man's record. Let's see whether he's been able to pay the bill or not in the time that he's had an opportunity to work out these problems that are in the world. If we go back to the time not long after the creation of Adam in the Garden of Eden, we find that the problems man had were relatively few. It's true they had problems with the environment, but the social and economic problems that are so plaguing the world today, they didn't have. Everything was very simple. But the few problems they had, they were not able to find a solution for. And what has happened is, instead of man being able to solve these problems have increased in both complexity and in number. So at this point, it's hopeless. So if man has not found a solution to these problems in 6,000 years, the chances of him finding a solution tomorrow or next year are pretty remote. So if we use the standards that man uses himself, that is looking at the record to see how these people perform, then man has performed, he hasn't performed at all. He's minus, perhaps, negative in his approach. So when we really analyze the situation, we see that the world today is out of control, absolutely out of control, as far as man is concerned. Maybe many of us came here by air. Can you imagine flying in one of those giants of the sky without a pilot, without anybody at the controls? It would be a frightening experience, enough perhaps to cause a cardiac arrest. Well, if we do not believe that God is in control of the world today, then we're flying in a jet with no pilot, because man has demonstrated for 6,000 years that he can't fly it. And we're drawing nearer and nearer from the things we pointed out for the day of reckoning, when this thing is either going to have to be successfully landed or it's going to crash, one or the other, because man has at his disposal the means of destroying himself. So unless we're going to believe that we're in a giant jet with no pilot, then we've got to recognize that God is at the controls. That through the providential guidance that he is directing the affairs of man, This is what we must believe. Now, we don't see any outward manifestation of this, but Brother Robert Roberts, in his day, wrote a book that's very interesting, and it should be very helpful to us today. It's called The Ways of Providence. The way in which God, in an unseen manner, reaches out and directs the affairs of mankind, of individuals, and of nations, when the development of His plan and purpose requires it. Now, this is not to say that God directs every minute detail in the world or even in anybody's life. But when the development of His plan and purpose requires it, His providential hand is extended, and it is very active. Now, to go back to what the brethren were looking for in the time that we are talking about, another thing they looked for as the time of the end drew near was that the living the truth would become increasingly more difficult. There was a lot of talk about this. It was even suggested that physical persecution might again be an evidence for the household. Now, when we've talked about the prophecy that has been fulfilled that they were looking for, but now we might say this is one they missed on, because the physical persecution has not been reinstituted. We are living in a time when everyone is free to do as he sees fit. There's probably more freedom of action and better access to God's Word than at any time in the history of the world. As a matter of fact, it might be said that this is the easiest time to live the truth since the ascension of Christ to the right hand of God, and that there is just nothing obstructing us. Nothing? I hope. I don't think anybody here is thinking like this, and I hope not. Because when we face the realities, we've already alluded to this, this is perhaps the most difficult time to live the truth in the history of the truth since the time of Christ and the apostles. And we say this knowing about the physical persecution that the followers of Christ in the first and second century suffered. Now, our lives are not geared, I'm sure, to that kind of physical persecution that they suffered. But what we're faced with is something that is just as deadly and maybe much more dangerous. Because we are not always aware of these things about us that may cause us to compromise our position. We, in times past, and even in the lifetime of many of us here, we could think mostly in black and white. Either you were right or you were wrong. But there are getting to be more and more gray areas, areas that are uncertain. What should be the course? What our course of action? What should we do? And one of our concerns is the fact that we may never, at any time in our lives, be faced with one single situation that would in itself compromise our position. That is, irretrievably compromise our position. But what we are faced with is a series of situations, any one of which is not serious in itself, but all taken together can constitute real problems and real compromises for us. Now, one of the first factors that we would like to talk about is materialism. Now, this has been a problem for a long time, and in recent years we've heard a lot about it among other religious groups, too. Not so much now as we were hearing a few years back, but this doesn't mean that it's no longer a concern or should not be a concern. It is a concern, and more of a concern possibly now than it was at a time when a lot was being said about it. Because when nothing's being said, we don't recognize, or we may not recognize, the dangers involved. You know, if there's a serpent out there in the grass, And if there's a lot said about it and we know where he is, the danger's not so great. But if we don't know where he is and we don't even realize he's there, then we better look out because he's liable to get us. Now, the man has had some 6,000 years in which to develop all kinds of material things that appeal to the human flesh. Now, we being mortals, of course, these things appeal to us. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't have material things. Of course, we have. It's necessary to use an expression that's sometimes used to keep soul and body together. It's necessary to have a certain amount of material things. And it doesn't mean we can't have a great deal or a good number of material blessings. This in itself is not necessarily bad. However, we're living in a competitive age in which acquiring material things requires a lot of time and effort. And if these things begin to loom very important in our lives, they may tend to crowd our spiritual values to the back and in the background and may crowd them out of our minds and lives altogether. We are living in a time when one's ability or lack of it to acquire material things determines strictly his success or failure in life. And this should not be, because the real measure of success is one's spiritual values, his strength spiritually, his ability to find happiness and satisfaction out of what he does, and not by the amount of material wealth that he's able to acquire in a lifetime. Another thing that concerns us and makes it difficult is the spirit of liberalism and permissiveness that we see so widespread in the world. We've referred to this already. But the people around us no longer recognize the standards of right and wrong as laid down by the Word of God. They say, in effect, that there are no standards of right and wrong, but everybody should be allowed to do his own thing, that you should not stifle the development of children's character and of adults either by telling them they can't do this or that, and the things they want to do are immoral. You should not do this. You should let them expand their character, and this is the way they grow, it is said. No standards of right and wrong. No need for me to tell you that this is not in keeping with the Word of God. Now, in all of these things that we see about us that cause difficulty, there is another difficulty itself, and that is maintaining the proper balance. Because we can become extreme when we see people that are so permissive and liberal. We can go to an extreme in dealing with problems in the truth, of course, in this connection. Or we can go to the extreme that they are. It's very easy for us to go to one extreme or the other. But the proper position is one of balance, of being able to maintain the same spiritual position that was correct 50 years ago, 100 years ago, or clear back to the time of Christ. There's a little example, comparison, parable, if you please, that we would like to call to your attention that we believe possibly illustrates this point. And that is, let us suppose that we are involved in a do-it-yourself project. Now, we're going to talk about the way, what would come about if we had no standards. You know, everybody thinks his own way and does whatever he wants to do. Now, you're involved in a do-it-yourself project, and let us say you're enclosing an area, and in the West we call this a patio. It's a Spanish word for courtyard. I don't know what you would call it here, but I'm sure you have these areas. And you're going to enclose this, and you're going to need some material to use in doing this. So first of all, you're going to need a piece of pipe. You've got the water over here to a point, and you want it over here. So you measure this. It's 10 feet, exactly 10 feet. So, okay, you write down, need a piece of pipe 10 feet long. You're going to need some boards. So you measure the area where you're going to put the boards, and those boards need to be 8 feet long. And you're going to need some nails to drive in the boards and nail them up. So you go down to a plumbing shop and you order a piece of pipe 10 feet long. You go down to the lumber yard and you order boards, a certain number of boards, 8 feet high or 8 feet long. And you go to the hardware store and you order 10 pounds of nails. So you give them time to take care of all these things for you, and you go back and you get your pipe and lumber and nails. And the first thing you want to do is hook up the water. So you take the pipe and you put it in there, and lo and behold, it's 9 feet 6 inches long, and it's too short. You can't use it. So you call up the plumbing shop and you say, "Hey, I ordered that 10 feet long." And the plumber says, "Well, it is 10 feet long according to my standards. If you use some other standards, that's just too bad. But that's 10 feet long according to my standards." So you get your boards out to put them up, and 8 feet long, and you find out they're 8.5 feet long. So you call up the lumber yard, and he says the same thing. He says, "According to my standards, those are 8 feet long." And the nails, you look at the nails, 10 pounds of nails, and it can't be 10 pounds. You weigh them, and it's 8 pounds. The hardware store says the same thing. That's 10 pounds, according to our standards. Well, now, you can readily recognize the chaos that would result from a situation like that. It would be intolerable in this time of age of mechanics that we live in if there were not a recognized standard of weights and measures. Now, this is not going to happen, of course, because of the Bureau of Weights and Measures in Washington that specifies how long a foot is and how heavy a pound is and all the other units of weight and measure. They tell us this. Now, in a social order, we must have a standard of right and wrong. If not, ultimately, chaos will result. There's no way to avoid it. And now, in this case, we too have a Bureau of Weights and Measures that tells us what is right and what is wrong. And you know what it is. We all know. It's the Word of God that describes to us what is right for us to do and what is wrong. Now, usually, when God tells us something should be done or should not be done, there's a reason for it. There's a logical reason why something's right and why it's wrong. But there doesn't have to be. Whatever God says, that is law. That is the standard of what's right and wrong. But there usually is a reason. For instance, when it says, "Let not the sun go down upon your wrath." If you're angry with somebody, straighten this thing out. Don't let that continue on and on. Why? Did you ever try to sleep when you were upset about being angry with somebody, having trouble with somebody? Did you ever have indigestion as a result of this? So we can see reasons for, as we've said, generally there are good reasons for why God has said something should be done this way or should not be done that way, but there does not have to be a reason. But now, to go back to the idea of no standards, people have experimented in recent years, of course, of living together with no recognized standards. And as a result, they have been subjected, and oftentimes from their own people and their own kind, to practically every hideous and immoral crime known to man. And these experiments have ended in failure. They come to recognize that you cannot do it this way. That there has to be some recognized standards of right and wrong. Now we talk about our position in all of this and what we should do or should not do. And a moment ago we talked about the fact that we're apt to think when we hear something, we're apt to say, "I wish Brother X were here." Well, now the philosophy involved here is that when we like to do something we're interested in that appeals to us, that we're apt to think it's all right to do it. Now, unless there's something, "Thou shalt not," we go to some extreme position, "Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not murder." Now, we recognize, of course, we can't go out and kill somebody. And there are many things, of course, that are specifically forbidden. So we're not talking about things like that. That's not in this category at all. What we're talking about is things that might be in the gray area. But now, if Brother X wants to do something, we can very quickly, and it's something that does not appeal to us, we can very quickly say, you mustn't do that. You can't do that. That's wrong. But if it's something we like, you'd be surprised how easy it is for us to find a way of justifying what we want to do and why we like it. And we can make such a good case for it that we're apt to believe it ourselves. It has been said that we can deceive each other, and we can even deceive ourselves in all of this. But we, of course, cannot deceive God. And the thing that we should remember in all of this is what Jeremiah said when he said, "The heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." So we can be deceived by our own thinking, by our own fleshly, carnal mind, into justifying almost anything that we want to do, if it isn't specifically forbidden in the Scripture. Now, you know, years ago, Brother Dunaway used to use an example, but many of you here may know him or know who he was. He, of course, was from Arkansas and associated with the Arkansas Bible School for many years. And he had a little example that he oftentimes told there to illustrate this point. He said there's a wealthy man with a big, long, black limousine went out to hire a chauffeur. And he took these two men out. They applied for the job, and he interviewed them, and they seemed all right if they could drive well. So he took them out on a very steep, narrow, winding mountain road. And along the road, there was an embankment on the outside that hundreds of feet high. So he told the first one, he said, "Let's see how close you can drive to the edge of this road." And he got right out on the very edge, driving right along the very edge of that embankment, and because he was a marvelous driver. But he took the next one and told him the same thing. But instead of him driving right out on the edge, he got as far over away from the edge as he could, and he is the man he hired. He gave him the job. Now, what's the lesson for this, in this? Let's don't see how close to the edge we can get. For good measure, let's get away from the edge and get over into things that we know there's no question about. Let's don't see how many things we can try to justify doing that we like to do or that somebody else likes to do, but let's rather see how far away we can get from this embankment and how far away we can get from these things that are questionable and that might be wrong. Is time up? Must be.